People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
Earlier this year, California passed two pieces of legislation, ABX 126 and 27, that could have major consequences for affordable housing. On today's edition of the Affordable Housing Podcast, we will focus on the pending state Supreme Court decisions, on the legality of these bills, and more generally how the future looks for redevelopment agency financing. I'm Joanne Green, and my guest today is Michael Kiley, a partner in the Real Estate and Land Use and Natural Resources Practice Groups of the firm Shepherd Mullin in the Los Angeles office. Michael has extensive experience in real estate development transactions with a public-private emphasis, including redevelopment, relocation, mixed-use and transit-oriented development projects, and public finance, including tax increment financing. These days, Michael is working with a number of clients on transactions that involve redevelopment agency financing, and he recently co-authored a blog piece on ABX 126 and 27. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I want to start out by providing a bit of background on why this issue is key to future funding of affordable housing in California. So correct me if I'm wrong with any of this, but redevelopment tax increment financing provides nearly $1 billion a year for affordable housing because the state requires that 20% of the tax increment be set aside to produce and preserve affordable housing. The funds have also been used to finance major revitalization projects throughout the state. So, Mike, if you could, let's start out by explaining what each of the two bills in question are supposed to do. They were passed as part of the legislature's effort to balance the budget, right?
Right. And as you note, a lot of money, $1 billion perhaps for affordable housing and substantially more than that for other redevelopment purposes, get pulled out of property taxes and funneled into redevelopment agencies. And for several years, the state has been looking to those funds and trying to get their hands on those funds to try to ease the budget deficits that keep cropping up in Sacramento. So this year, when it was basically his first thing into office, Governor Brown said, we're going to do it this year. This is the year we're going to get the money from the redevelopment agencies. So what ended up happening after about 6 months of debate was the adoption of ABX 126 and ABX 127. 26 is basically what I call the kill bill, and its goal would be to put redevelopment agencies out of business. It would say from the effective date of the bill until October 1, 2011, agencies can't do anything. Thereafter, agencies go out of business, and successor agencies are created to repay the existing indebtedness of the agencies to complete the performance of existing contractual obligations and otherwise wind down the operations of the agencies, thereby preserving the agency assets for the benefit of the other taxing agencies that would end up getting the money, primarily education, education in the counties. ABX 127, sometimes called the continuation bill, says, hey, you know, I know what we said in 26, but we were just kidding. Instead, you could make a voluntary payment, and we say you, the local government, which is typically a city, associated with each agency, can make a payment into a special district allocation fund, an educational revenue fund established for each county. And if you make that payment, then your agency can stay in business as usual. The amount of the payment was based on a target number for the first year, which is the fiscal year of 2011-2012, of $1.7 billion. So basically what they do is they add up all the agency tax increment for, I think it was 2009, and they say whatever each agency's share of that was, then they have to make a corresponding payment of the $1.7 billion. So the largest agency, for example, is the City of Los Angeles Redevelopment Agency, and their share of $1.7 ended up being close to $100 million. It's a lot. For years after 2012, they would have to make payments of roughly 35% of that amount. It's effectively something like 23% plus some – there's a formula that it gets up to about 30 to 35% of what they ended up what they'll end up paying for this fiscal year.
It's so nice that it's so simple, right? The whole formula is so easy to understand and easy to implement.
Yeah, and I realized that just then I was already rambling, and that was the truncated version.
I'm sure. But, you know, within weeks after these bills were signed, there were legal challenges, right, from California Redevelopment Association, the California League of Cities, among others. There are two specific legal challenges, one in the California Supreme Court and one at the Superior Court level. So first, for our listeners who are not attorneys, can you explain why there would be two suits at two different levels of the courts?
Sure. The California League of Cities and the California Redevelopment Association, which is the sort of the trade association of redevelopment agencies, sought what's called original jurisdiction in the California Supreme Court. And what that means is, you know, normally you file a lawsuit, you go to the trial court level, which is the superior court, and then if you don't like the result, you can appeal it to an appellate court, and if you don't like that result, you can appeal it to the Supreme Court. So what they reasoned was, look, this is an issue of importance to over 400 cities and counties in California, all of whom have a vital interest in it, so let's just jump right to the top and get the decision. So they petitioned the Supreme Court for original jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court granted that in August. A second suit was filed in September by a group of 10 Southern California cities. The state immediately responded and said, you know, it's a related case. In effect, that case got stopped, and it's sort of hanging out pending the results of the California Supreme Court case. Although the state court case, or excuse me, the lower court case isn't gone yet, it still exists. It did raise a number of issues that weren't raised in the Supreme Court case. But it's hard to imagine how that case could survive, whichever way the Supreme Court decision turns out.
So the Supreme Court is supposed to decide the cases by January 15th, 2012, and there appear to be three possible outcomes. In option one, the Supreme Court could strike down both bills. So what happens if both bills are then deemed unconstitutional?
Well, if both go down, then we're kind of back to step one, same place we were in January. The predominant thing for the first 6 months of 2011 in redevelopment was uncertainty, right? You couldn't work out a redevelopment deal because you didn't know what was going to happen. Hard to finish a redevelopment deal. There were proposals that said they would reach back even before the bill was adopted. So what happened was nothing. And development is hard enough in 2011 and presumably will be in 2012 because of, you know, lack of debt availability and you know, other economic issues that are making development challenging. Not having redevelopment was a real problem. So the uncertainty will continue. The budget crisis will remain. I believe that it's likely that the legislature and the governor would try again to either – you know, whether it's some kind of two-step approach that results in an effective funding cut for redevelopment or whether they just try to abolish redevelopment altogether. I think you're going to find that the problem continues and there's going to be more legislation that tries to get it right.
So another option is the Supreme Court rules that both bills are constitutional, right? What do you envision happening if that's the ruling?
Well, for those of us in the redevelopment area, that's sort of good. As I like to say, then it would be back to business as usual, but less so. I mean, the funding cut will have been achieved. That was the legislature and the governor's goal. But there will still be redevelopment. The rest of redevelopment rules will remain in place. The redevelopments will have roughly 60% or 70% of the funds they had before, but they'll be able to do the same kinds of transactions they were doing before. So is that bad for redevelopment? Sure. It's not fatal, though. And then the good news is we would have certainty and we could get back to work.
Right. And then there's option three, where the Supreme Court might uphold ABX 126, eliminating RDAs, but then deem ABX 127 unconstitutional, thereby forcing them out of business.
Right. And I think this is a real possibility. This is the option that the county of Santa Clara pushed in its amicus brief with the Supreme Court. And I think that the governor would be pretty happy about this because that would do even more to help the budget situation than what actually got adopted. It would obviously be the worst case scenario for redevelopment agencies and, frankly, the worst case scenario for affordable housing.
The Supreme Court recently heard arguments in the case. Can you talk about what kind of questions they asked? And do you think their line of questioning gives any indication about what they might be thinking?
Sure. Based on their questions, it appeared that the justices were satisfied that 26, the bill abolishing the agencies, would pass constitutional muster. However, 27, the bill allowing for the reinstatement by making voluntary payments, seemed to be on a little bit shakier grounds. So the question becomes, are the two inexorably intertwined in a way that, they must stand or fall together, or is 27 severable from 26? Based on their questions, the justices seem convinced that, you know, redevelopment agencies are creatures of statute, and the legislatures that created the redevelopment agency would have the power to abolish them. In under questioning, the Council for the Redevelopment Association actually conceded the point, but argued that because 26 was adopted with 27, that it resulted in a transfer of funds that would violate the Constitution, specifically Proposition 22, which was adopted about a year ago, and said that you couldn't require redevelopment agencies to transfer their funds to other taxing agencies. So the way he phrased it was the legislature can't use a constitutional means, which would be ABX 126, to achieve an unconstitutional end, which is the violation of Prop 22. The state's lawyers argue that, no, you know, 27 is voluntary. Prop 22 says you can't require funds to be diverted, and if it's voluntary, then they're not required. I thought that the questioning seemed to indicate that the justices weren't buying that linkage the way that the Redevelopment Association were pushing it. I've read other commentators who watched the same oral argument and kind of came out the other way. So, you know, should be careful of predicting what a court's going to do based on watching them ask questions for an hour.
But you can't help yourself, right?
Sure. But I can't help myself. I'm tired of predicting. I've been making predictions on this redevelopment stuff since, you know, January 5th, and I keep getting it wrong. So Section 5 of ABX 127 does say that if the provisions of 27 are held invalid, the provisions of of 26 will continue in effect. Now, the Council for the Redevelopment Association said that you had to go further than the wording of the statute. You had to look behind it and say, you know, gee, would the legislature have adopted 26 even if 27 wasn't there? And pointed to the legislative history of the bills, you know, including probably references to fights that broke out on the floor of the assembly, showing that it wasn't the intent of the legislature to do that. You know, whether it's required for a court to go back and look at the legislative history that way, I don't know that I think that's right. So I think that the outcome of both of them being struck down is probably the least likely of the three outcomes, but I'm not sure I can predict which of the other two is more likely.
So you've been working on many projects throughout the state during this interim period. The court issued a stay on the redevelopment agencies. So first, can you describe what the stay did to current RDA activity?
Yeah, actually, the stay, it's a little bit inverted from that. So the legislation that got adopted, ABX 126, what it said was from the time of adoption of the ordinance or the law until agencies went out of business, the agencies weren't authorized to enter new agreements, amend existing agreements, you know, enter DDAs, enter OPAs, enter loan agreements. They weren't allowed to do anything or amend anything that they had been party to before. The court, what it did in its action in August was to stay the legislation to say, all right, the agencies are not going to go out of business, but it issued an exception to the stay, which said, when we're staying this legislation, we're not staying the portion of the legislation that says the agencies can't do anything. So what they were trying to do in both the law and then in the exception to the stay by the court was to freeze the status quo. So agencies were stopped from entering new OPAs and DDAs, loan agreements, and so forth. They were only allowed to perform existing obligations. The problem is figuring out what an existing obligation is. So, for example, if a redevelopment agency has a DDA, disposition and development agreement, which is really like a purchase and sale agreement to sell a piece of property for a dollar, right? And that's not an impossible scenario. That seems like a contract, an existing obligation. The problem is that DDA typically would have a whole bunch of conditions for the benefit of the agency, right? The agency has to approve a scope of development for the project. Project needs to get entitled. Developer needs to show evidence of financing and so forth. Would the agency be allowed to modify or waive those conditions under the restrictions of ABX 126 that were not stayed by the court? Probably a technical reading would say no. Some agencies have said, some people, they've taken a more aggressive approach and said sure. If an agency was the landlord under a lease, could it agree to a modification of that lease? I'm facing that in a transaction I'm working on. Not sure. Maybe it could extend the term. Maybe it could approve an assignment, but could it lower the rent? Probably not. So that's what's been going on with agencies for the last few months. A lot of confusion, a lot of agencies sort of moving in opposition or without regard to the advice of counsel that their actions might actually be violating the provisions of 26.
So, Michael, what's going to happen to projects that are in process right now if the court eliminates the agencies with no way for them to stay alive?
Same kind of issues. I think we've gotten a taste of it. So it's those, the way the rules are written, if you were, for example, a bondholder and your bond had a schedule of payment amounts and dates attached to it, then the rules are very clear. You're going to get paid. That's an existing obligation. The problem is, how do you apply the language that describes existing obligations to a contract like the one I just described? A redevelopment deal or an agreement with a developer, like an owner participation agreement, is a contract that usually takes years to play out, right? As projects get financed and then they get started and then they get constructed and then they get leased up. And sometimes there's obligations that go on, certain types of lease up obligations so far that go on for years after that. Would the successor agencies administer those contracts? If that contract called for the issuance of a bond upon completion, is the successor agency going to go through the process of actually issuing that bond upon completion? I think those are questions that are very ambiguous. In addition, there's a lot of provisions in the law which suggest that contracts that were entered into before the legislation was adopted could be challenged or unwound. Those provisions, I think, are, there's at least a question whether it would be that's constitutionally permissible legislation. So I think you could expect some litigation. So the play out ought to be that, successor agencies, the education boards and the county who want more money should be trying to unwind as many agency obligations as they can and looking for ways to do that. That's what should happen. Under the legislation, how that plays out, I think nobody really knows at this point.
So we hear that the court is supposed to decide the cases by January 15th. When do you think they're going to give a final decision?
January 15th was the date that the first half of the first year's payment is due. And I think that's why they came up with January 15th. It was also tied into, that's roughly halfway through the budget year. And so I think it's tied into that as well. I think there's a good chance that they will issue by then. I mean, I at least one justice has stated that they're going to try and issue something in December. But you can't predict that.
I mentioned earlier that you co-authored a blog piece. Where might our listeners find that?
They probably should, rather than reading out a lengthy address, they should probably go to my law firm's website, which is shepherdmullen.com. And there's a link to the construction and real estate law blog. And actually, you'll find that there's four blog pieces that I've written relative to the pending legislation.
Great. Maybe we can link to those on Eden Housing's site as well.
Great.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today on the Affordable Housing Podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Michael Kiley is a partner in the law firm of Shepherd Mullen. For more information, please visit edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.